The Tree is a movie about a woman named...
Dorothy?
Yes.
Do you have your Medicare card with you?
I'm sure I do somewhere.
Dorothy is an older woman living alone in the town where she raised her daughter. Her daughter has moved away, but her neighbors keep an eye on her and she gets around okay. Her friends, though, are dying, and she's not convinced that her routine of doctor's appointments and dishes is really how she wants to be spending her time. And I mean, can you blame her?
Do you have your Part D card, too?
I think so.
I need to make copies for your file.
I think they did that last time I was here.
Oh, I see last year's Part C, but not this year's Part D. And just a heads up, we won't be accepting Part C after this year.
What does that mean?
That means if you want to stay with Part C, then you're going to need to find a new primary care doctor.
I've been coming here for 46 years.
Then you'll need to cancel your Part C coverage and move back into Parts A and B.
This is not how Dorothy wants to spend her time. What she wants to do is go on a road trip by herself back to the town where she grew up, and Dorothy is not fazed by the doctors, neighbors, and well-meaning people along the way who pretty consistently seem to think she shouldn't be driving at all. Something is calling her back, and it's powerful. I'm Gina Kaufman, and we'll be hearing that story now on KCUR's Central Standard. I'm here with one of the local directors, part of a husband and wife team that made the movie, Stephen Pruitt. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. What is it that is calling Dorothy back home in The Tree?
You know, it's the sort of thing that, I don't want to give any spoilers away here, but I think we all have a place that we'd like to be at some point. I mean, we think about where would you like to go again, you know, one last time. And I think that's what The Tree is all about.
This plot is based actually on the relationship between your mother and one of her childhood friends.
That's
is that
correct.
Right?
That's correct.
Tell me about that.
Yeah, my mom was her maiden name was Dorothy Thorpe. So this is very much her film, as it were. She had a childhood friend named Pat Jenkins, and she would tell us through the years about the various things she and Pat did, and this is just kind of the culmination of that. We were casting about for another film to make, and I thought, oh my gosh, we need to do the one about Mom.
The protagonist of this movie is a woman in probably her 80s.
88, actually, right.
And there have been a small handful of bigger movies that I've seen that have featured a woman of that age, but not a lot. And what was different about yours to me is that it didn't treat the older person as someone adorable. It wasn't condescending, or it wasn't for comic effect. Was that part of a mission for you?
I think that I wanted to be true to Mom. And so that was really what it was all about was, I mean, from the very moment I got the idea for the film, it was just like, you know, let's do one about Mom and Pat, and let's be true to Mom. And there are touches of her everywhere. I mean, the car that she drives in the film was actually my mom's car. The furniture in the house, in the bedroom, that was Mom's furniture. The pill dispenser was Mom's pill dispenser. A lot of the things that the actress says, you know, Joycey says in the film, those were actual lines that Mom used to say. So I just wanted to be true to her.
Can you give an example of a line she used to say?
Oh, absolutely. There was a... she's getting ready to leave, and Laura Kirk, a KU film professor, plays the next-door neighbor, Marge. And Marge says, you know, a lot of those little towns are not the way you remember them. You know, they're just little grease spots on the prairie. And that's what my mom used to say, you know, was talking about Terre Haute, Indiana, where she's headed back to in the film. It's just a little grease spot on the prairie now. So that's one of many lines that she would say.
What is it that... When you say that you wanted to make what you call Mom's movie,
right,
what does that mean to you? I mean, you know your mom, you know your relationship with her, but for what is this sort of universal thing in the story of your mom's relationship with that friend and your relationship with your mom that you wanted to speak to?
Yeah, I think, well, you know, we always talk about here in this country, you know, there's baseball, apple pie, and moms, and, you know, being the three sacrosanct, things in our lives. And certainly in my case, my mother, she actually died in 2014 of dementia. And it was, you know, seeing the long goodbye, as, you know, Reagan called it before his death. It, you know, this is not what Mom was. And I wanted to make a film about how Mom had been and how I wanted to remember her. So I think that's real. And I think all of us, you know, have this feeling about our own mothers. I mean,
do you think that, I mean, the storyline has Dorothy reclaiming who she had been for herself. Do you think that seeing this character do that for herself allows you to do that with your own mother?
Oh, there's no question that when we watched the film, I actually, it's getting to, it's really kind of funny that I'm getting to the point where I see Joycey in the film and I'm starting to see my mother. So it's just, I guess I've seen it too much. But no, I really feel that connection with this character. It's a beautiful thing. And I just want to, you know, just wanted to be true to that part of her.
There are shots in this movie of Dorothy's feet and lower legs as she walks, like a lot of sort of mid-shin down shots.
Right, right.
And then there are also these sort of off-camera angles as she enters a room. And it'll be for just a second. And it's almost like you're experiencing some mild disorientation as the viewer. Or there's also a pace that asks you as a viewer to slow down the way you might in conversation with an older person.
Right, right. Well, I think many people have noticed the several shots I have of you know, Dorothy's feet in the film. But I can just simply say that Dorothy lives in Kansas. Her name is Dorothy, and she's headed home. I mean,
God, I am thick. I didn't catch that.
Yeah, no, she's headed back home. She wants to go home. So that's really what it was for us, was her shoes, whatever she's wearing there, those are her ruby slippers, and they're going to take her home.
A lot of people on this journey that Dorothy takes from Wamego, Kansas to Terre Haute, Indiana, try to get her to change her plan. Like, there's a mechanic who tries to get her to change plan. There's the doctor on her way out of town, trying to get her to go into assisted living. And then her neighbors are the most compellingly, like, fraught with anxiety.
Right, absolutely.
There's almost, though, a refrain throughout the movie of people in situations like this telling her how much she would like something else.
Oh, here's the deal, is that I think the underlying theme of this film is aging and independence. And I think in this nation, we have somehow, you know, societally decided that, you know, senior citizens just don't have the agency to live the life that they want to live. And in this particular case, this is we wanted to make a film that was true to the way we all really want to live out our last years. And and Joycey just brought it
She's
to
the
fruition.
Actress.
Yeah, right. She just brought it together in a way that is just deeply moving to almost everyone who sees it.
So you, as you've been hinting, you wrote this movie, The Tree, for the actor who stars in it, Kansas City's Joycey Appel. We'll be talking to her soon, but I want to hear from you first. You know, she was 88 when you shot the film.
Correct.
And you really envisioned this as a vehicle for her to perform. Can you talk about that? Can you talk about why?
Absolutely. Well, first off, Mary and I, my wife Mary and I, we're the writers of the film. We write all our own films together. And but here's the deal. When we shot an earlier film that's yet to be released, but should be soon, it's called Terminal. And Joycey played a crucial role of an older neighbor in Western Kansas in that film. And she did such a brilliant job that Mary and I immediately said, you know, we need to. This is in 2010 when we met Joycey. And we were told during the audition, before she stepped up on stage, that we were about to meet a legend. And I thought, okay, well, this is great. You know, I've never met a legend before. Well, after she had me crying during her audition, which was, as soon as we were finished, I told Mary, I said, there is one person we must cast for this film, and that is Joycey Appel. You've got to get on the phone and get her to commit right now.
I mean, when in discussions about pop culture, you hear so much that it is hard for a woman in this business in particular, acting in film, that the aging process is not kind to women in the same way that it can, you know, turn a man into the distinguished gentleman.
Right, right. Distinguished men and old women, right? I mean, it's just kind of the cliche. But in this particular case, we didn't cast Joycey because she looked 29. We cast Joycey because of who she is and her ability to bring these beautiful characters to life. And in the case of Terminal, she just blew it away. And we immediately decided we're going to write a film about her. And that's just what we did.
We'll talk to Joycey, who plays Dorothy in The Tree, in just a minute. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standards. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and we've been talking about The Tree, a locally made movie about a lot of things, but what struck me was its perspective on aging, and that's thanks in large part to a compelling performance by Joycey Appel, who plays the main character, Dorothy, an older woman who's been dreaming of a special place from her childhood. So she decides to go back on a solo road trip, which scares the daylight out of her neighbors and pretty much everyone she meets along the way. Joycey Appel, good morning.
Good morning. How nice to be here, Gina.
It's nice to have you. Okay, so you have actually like this pretty wild resume behind you. Can you tell me about your background? Your acting background in particular.
Okay, started acting in commercial or two at age 16. Went into radio, then on to stage, and have had a long career on stage. And along that time came movies. And now I'm just having great fun in well-written movies.
Is there a soap opera chapter, or am I imagining that?
Just a tiny, tiny bit on Guiding Light, which is now gone. But I don't think it's anything really that anyone would remember one way or another, but it was fun and a great experience on television in New York.
So can you talk to me a little bit about this experience of doing a feature-length movie starring you and being specifically about the stage of life that you are in right now?
Well, it's a very unique experience. I think this is my 9th or 10th movie that I was in, and small roles, filmed with important people. But here we have two writers, producers, directors, wonderful cameraman, sound person, musician, all come together in something that I think we're all very proud of, because it is a good movie. It was made with good intentions, and it just turned out beautifully. So it's been a marvelous experience for me. And yes, to have a lead role was like a star falling out of heaven, you know, and catching it. It just was quite exciting to do.
You know, I was just talking with one of the directors about the older stages of life and how they are represented, not just in movies, but in our culture, like in this very one-dimensional way, or at least that's how I see it. I wonder what you think.
I never think about age. I didn't realize I was 88 until Steve told me I was playing his mother, who was 88, and wasn't it fun to be playing someone my age? I would always have to count back to 1928 and figure out just how old I am. And I still do that. I don't think about age, because who's not getting a day older, and what difference does it make? And it's something I don't think about.
That's really interesting to me. You know, when I was about 19, I had a professor who was much older than I was. I don't know how old she was, but she said to me once, in the context, she was just talking about literature, but she said, every age has its pleasures. And she had this look on her face that kind of intrigued me, like she knew something that I didn't, which was absolutely the case. And you kind of are reminding me of that, just this sort of idea of dread that people have about the aging process is not necessarily how we actually experience aging.
Well, it's so silly. Who's not getting a day older? You have this chance in life of being uniquely you, uniquely Gina, uniquely Joycey. Nobody else has that chance. Be as good as you can. Make the best of it. Do what's right. And you forget about aging. What difference does it make?
Right. It's just part of being authentically yourself at a particular moment.
Yes. And I'm amazed at people who want their body adjusted or their hair adjusted or something else adjusted. You know, if it isn't something that just is terribly horrible to them, why? Why? There's so many other ways we can spend our money for good in this world. If I had money to send to people who've suffered the tsunami, I would send it. Or the earthquake, I would send it. Why would I spend it on me when these people are needing help? It just makes no sense to me.
Were there particular scenes in The Tree, this movie that you starred in, that moved you particularly as you thought about them or thought about
yes,
how to act
one
them?
Where Kip Niven is the veteran in the doorway, and I pull a folding chair out of the back of my car and go sit and talk to him and bring him food to eat. And I love the scene just before that where I'm with the waitress who's had the hard life and try to help her out. But Steve and Mary Pruitt, the producers and writers, have put those scenes all through the movie. So it's really hard to pick out favorite ones. I enjoyed every day of the filming.
So what you're referring to for our listeners is that on this road trip that Joycey takes back to this special place in her hometown, she does a lot of stopping and interacting with people and kind of, I don't know, being sort of like an unwitting counselor in a way, like just being very open with people.
I think she's just being honest. It's nothing that she's trying to do. She's just being honest. She's just living the script that Steve and Mary wrote. And I think it's wonderful in this life when you come across an honest individual like Dorothy Thorpe and can meet somebody like that and certainly play somebody like that in a movie.
There was a scene that moved me that I want to talk about. I mean, it's a little earlier than the ones you're describing, but she, her car has had a little snafu, and so it's being worked on by a mechanic, and she decides that she sees a church and thinks of this as probably a place where she could just go sit and rest. And so she goes in there, and there is a grieving woman who is angry at some relatives who have kept something from her. And I'll just leave it at that. In a situation like that, I think most of us would slink away and not try to talk anyone out of how they're feeling. And Dorothy takes a different approach.
Yes, she's fearless in that sense. I think a lot of us, our nature would be, oh, excuse me, I didn't mean to interrupt you. I'll leave and go sit somewhere else.
And I can't wait to not be part of this.
Right.
What's happening
here? I think Dorothy felt this great need to help somebody. Doesn't know the name of these people. I don't think she ever knew the name of the waitress. She did know the name of the veteran in the doorway, but I don't think she knew the name of the waitress that she helped or these women that she helped in the church scene. And that's fine. That's the way we should leave our life. Do we have to have credit for everything that this was done by Dorothy Thorpe, you know, or this was done by Joycey Appel? No, we don't. We go about doing good, and that's enough.
Did you have input on the content? I know that you were saying that you were living the script that they wrote, but I am interested in, as I've mentioned, just that the perspective of aging seems, and I know that you don't think about aging.
No.
It just seems, though, that there is some degree of lived experience and firsthand experience rather than looking in from the outside that is somehow making its way into this story.
Probably so. Probably so. I don't think you can keep yourself out of what you do. But as an actor, we try to be as true to the written role and put as much of ourselves into that. One of the great experiences of my life was with Dr. McElrath, with Missouri Rep. I was touring in a couple of shows, touring around Missouri. And she came out to see one of the shows and complimented two of us for being the two members of the cast who are keeping the characters real. And that made an impression on me that, yes, that's the thing to do.
You know, there are these neighbor characters in the tree who feel guilty for letting Dorothy go on a road trip alone. What do you think of their worry and their sense of responsibility, their idea that they're responsible for her?
Well, they were being helpful and they were being loving. But there again, I think she stood up to it and did what she felt she needed to do. And we all need to be loving. And sometime when we're loving, that's not met with great kindness, but that's okay.
It's okay to disagree is what it seems
it
like
is
part of the takeaway here.
Of course it is. And my mom always said, M-Y-O-B, mind your own business. And if you find you're going across the line, then stop and pull back. And you've done what you could, so forget it.
Stephen Pruitt, you know, you are one of the filmmakers, and I want to bring you back in on this. What has this intergenerational dialogue been like for you?
Well, it's just been a remarkable experience. I mean, as I said, when we wrote the film, we had Joycey in mind, and everything she did was just so amazing. And it was just one of the great privileges of our life. Certainly, the great film privilege of our life was to have Joycey bring this incredible character to life. And I just couldn't say enough good things about it.
Joycey, do you find that it is that you are able to get roles when you would like them, and that there are those roles available for an actress at your stage in life?
My goal in life growing up was to be a good wife and mother. And I thought before that I was going to be a good English teacher and a good teacher of English lit. When I fell into acting, it started a whole new thing for me. So I didn't plan ahead, and I don't now. If a role comes my way, I can go ahead and take it. Never resented not getting a role. I thought that was the time for that person to have that role. And I never wanted anyone to be envious or jealous of me for getting a role, because their time would come some other time.
You're like a spiritual guru.
Really?
She is.
Yeah, because like this whole like this relinquishing of control and
Well, we who's going to live our own life if we don't? You know, and we can't live other people's lives. If they're meant to be a great star and make a lot of money, why should I be envious? I'm happy in my own life, whatever tomorrow brings, and I never know what it's going to bring. But it's never disappointed me.
Well, Stephen Pruitt, I do want to get back to you for just a moment. This is based, as we've said, on your own mom's story.
Right.
Do you feel like the experience of making a movie that was so closely hewn to the life of a loved one who you have lost, did you learn something about her that you never realized?
You know, I'm not sure. I can certainly say that seeing the film and seeing Joycey in the film is very much like watching Mom again. It's a beautiful thing to see this, and you know, when she's doing her thing on screen, it's just like, oh my gosh, it's a thing of beauty. What else can I say?
What do you hope people get from The Tree?
Well, I hope they log onto our website, thetreemotionpicture.com, and buy a DVD or Blu-ray or something like that. We just feel like this film has the potential to touch so many people in so many ways. I can't tell you the number of a film critic in Kansas, Laura Kirk, was talking to. She's a co-star of the film. Just last week, said it was the best film he'd seen in 10 years. And it's just like, wow, you know, that's a beautiful thing.
Well, Stephen Pruitt, Joycey Appel, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Gina.
Thank you. Really appreciate it.
And as Stephen just said, you can watch The Tree in a lot of places, iOS, Android, lots of options, or just head to the movie's website, thetreemotionpicture.com. I'm Gina Kaufman, and in just a minute, a familiar figure in Kansas City is preparing for a homecoming with a new book in tow. Pelham McDaniels joins us next on KCUR's Central Standard. We We are back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. And now Pelham McDaniels III, a former Chiefs player, is with us. He is also a professor who used to teach history and American studies here at UMKC, and he's moved on to join the staff at Emory in Atlanta. He has a new book called The Hemp Breakers. He'll be coming to the library to talk about it on October 10th, and we're going to talk to him now. Hi, Pelham.
Hi, Gina. How are you doing?
Good. It's great to have you back on the show.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear your voice.
Yours too. Tell me about the new book.
Well, The Hemp Breakers is actually a 10-12 year journey through the archives for me. When I was working on the Isaac Murphy biography, I would come across these different bits and pieces of African American history and life from West Africa during slavery through the Great Migration in the 19-teens, and just, different little bits and pieces that I found to be significant, but they were not connected to a larger narrative. For instance, is in the book, there is a ballot to Igbo Sue, and this was a woman who was accounted for in newspapers in the 1820s, 1830s. She was a runaway, a woman who ran away, who was enslaved. And all we had that really accounted for her existence was this description of her of bearing her country's marks, which was scarification on her face, indicative of Igbo people of Nigeria, and what she wore, her occupation as a cook. But that was it. And I thought, well, we have to remember this woman. We have to figure out a way, or rather, I have to figure out a way to connect her to this larger narrative related to, the triangular trade, to her origins in West Africa, to the striving of the freedmen during Reconstruction.
Can I jump in?
So,
I want to ask you what you mean in a little more detail when you say we have to remember this woman.
Well, one of the things I've learned in my work and in this research is that we have a tendency to gravitate towards the stories that seem to be the most important. I mean, we know quite a bit about W.E.B. Du Bois. We know a lot about Dr. King. But there are other people who survived the institution of slavery that, whose resistance and resilience allow for, me to be here. And I think those stories have to be told because they make up the tissue of the history that we know to be important.
So I want, before we go too much further, I want you to read the opening passage of this book. Like I've said, this is a novel, and you're coming from an academic background where you've done a lot of academic writing. And I want people to hear how different this is before we talk about how different it is. So all we know as we come upon this passage is that this is set in Frankfort, Kentucky in 1870. Can you begin?
Okay. In the darkness, Big Blue struggles to remember the details of Sadie's face. Was her skin high yellow, cocoa brown, walnut, or soft mahogany? What shape was her face? Was it round or oval? Did she have angled features like a black Indian? Were her eyes deep brown or hazel with green flower-like irises? He couldn't be sure. It had been at least 7 years since he last saw her. That was 1864. Now, in the darkness, he hears Sadie humming, a melody that reverberates in his head and in some deeply embedded place between his backbone and his breastbone. In the darkness, where emptiness and shadows merge into an open space, waiting to be filled with his imagination. In Big Blue's mind's eye, he sees himself sitting in a field of spring clover at sunrise. He watches as orange and yellow butterflies dance on the westward winds, rise on the breeze, and drift off free. In his mind, the softness of Sadie's voice intensifies as the sunlight comes over the peak of a great mountaintop in the distance. Red Robin, why do you come so softly? Red Robin, how's the weather up there? Can you tell me what the future holds? What's coming on the winds of change? Red Robin, why do you come so softly?
I admit,
that's it.
I wanted you to sing. but partly because I was curious how you heard that passage. But okay, so this opens with a very detailed description of someone imagining someone else's facial features. And the way that ties into conversations about race is interesting to me. I mean, can you talk about that opening passage and why you began the way you did?
Well, this story, again, I'll go back to the origins, you know, bits and pieces of, and fragments rather, of people's lives related to, again, African-American history, the African diaspora, really, and trying to figure out how to tell this story, and eventually working with the editor, it really kind of becomes this odyssey of one individual whose name is Blue. And, you know, after kind of massaging it and moving it around, it made sense to kind of to frame this in a way that allows for us to understand, you know, this individual has both memories of his own life, but there are these memories that are almost inherent in his DNA. And so this idea of memory is central to the story of Blue, but also central to, you know, African-American history.
It makes me think about then putting myself in your shoes a little bit as someone in going through archives and stumbling upon just fragments of other people's lived experience and not having the complete picture, that the way that you're searching your own mind, trying to finish the picture, trying to, you know, can you take me back to that experience for you, for yourself?
Yes. I mean, you know, again, when I was working on Murphy, and this is important because I had to
remind us what that project was.
Yeah. So Isaac Murphy is still noted as the most successful jockey in horse racing history, having died at the age of 35 with a 44% winning percentage. Winning in his horse races, was the first jockey to win three Kentucky Derbies, 1884, 1890, 1891. But part of the framework for that book was to understand how horse racing develops in the United States from the time, you know, but when Kentucky was the westernmost county of Virginia. And part of this was understanding how then the slave trade influenced the development of horse racing, because horse racing, of course, was a wealthy man's kind of venture. And those that worked the land were the same ones who worked the horses, rode the horses, groomed the horses. And so in finding and looking for information about the development of horse racing, I came across these different bits and pieces in the archives looking for Murphy for, you know, 7 to 10 years. And so these fragments were part of the larger story, but were not necessarily displaced, but were never connected to the larger narrative. And so I kept those little bits and pieces and files and, you know, in memories and journals. And then at one point I decided that there's another story here that needs to be told. That underpins all that we know based on the available evidence. And so there are these gaps in our own history, and therefore in our memories, collective memories, related to this history that needs some exploration.
So you turned to fiction as a person with, you know, you started out at your career as a football player and then moved into this academic role as a professor and then into a role later on in there in Atlanta at Emory as a curator. And now at this stage for fiction to emerge and, right. and to emerge in part out of the absence of answers to some of your questions,
yes.
that you have to make them up. What was that like?
It was liberating. The best example I can give you, I've read these different slave narratives where, you know, they've talked about Africans could fly. And the idea that Africans would fly really had more to do with they were runaways who disappeared. And so the explanation was that these Africans flew back to Africa. And that was always something that was like, again, like the splinter in one's mind, it just is there. And it just kind of was always in the back of my mind, in my mind. And then you read a Toni Morrison, you know, Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, where there's the one passage about Milkman where he, you know, leaps off the rock and it says, if you catch the wind, you can ride it. And so these different stories they're part of this larger African-American, African diasporic history and even the folklore, of course. But I always wondered why could these Africans fly? What made this why was this something that was a possibility in terms of not only the folklore? So in the novel, in the second story after the first opening with Blue, I create this scenario where I explain indirectly why Africans could fly. And it's really rooted in the land and the cultivation of the yam, which, you know, is a sweet potato here in the United States, but it was also imported from West Africa. So the idea of a source of food that comes from the land that you ingest makes you African allows for you then to be able to travel back to your origin. And so there are these origin stories that are also part of this novel that help explain some of the folklore, at least from my perspective and in my research.
So the idea that this was liberating, can you talk about the language of your fiction? And was that a discovery for you, what your own voice was like in this medium? Because I will admit, when I hear about someone coming into a literary kind of writing after being an academic, I prepare myself for academic sounding literature. And that's not what this is. It's not.
Well, what is it? What is it? What is your interpretation?
I think it's very musical.
Okay. And that's what I was going for. And this, the thing about this particular book is that I couldn't find a publisher for it, which is why I had to go with the small press. Agents, I had two different agents and they said, I don't know how to sell this. And I was like, have you ever read Gene Toomer's Cain? It's, you know, a series of vignettes that tells a story, and it's not just, you know, a book of fiction, prose, you know, it's not just poetry. It's a combination of all because the nature of African-American history, as most of us know, it's fragmented. You know, we move from, you know, slavery, Reconstruction, and we leap over the early part of the 20th century. We have Harlem Renaissance, but we have Jim Crow, which is a big part of it. But most of that history has been fragmented. And so the whole style and approach of the book has been these fragments trying to tell a whole story. And so the voice that you have in this book is someone who is listening to the stories of people's lives that have been silenced over time. But still resonate with, you know, with us today. But we just have to listen for their voices.
And in my limited experience with writing a book-length project, there are characters who can kind of become like companions to you. Yes. And then even when you're done writing, you find them sort of accompanying you through your life. Is there a character who accompanies you now?
It would be Blue. Blue is a man who was born, into slavery. He becomes a Union soldier, and he learns, you know, how to read and write while he's in service, and he records his life through letters to his wife, to Sadie. But even as he moves through life, and he's understanding how he can achieve great things, and that's just, you know, really securing his freedom. He's also having to understand that there are people outside of his particular circle who don't want him to achieve that. And so he prepares himself for that refusal. But even as he moves forward in his life, he understands that, there are other things, other factors that have to be accounted for. The tragedy is that he loses his family, and this is part of the story. Of kind of the self-exploration. And this is where we find him at the opening of the novel.
You know, I'm curious about how that story of someone dealing with others not necessarily wanting him to succeed, is that something that you can relate to?
Well, this is the conundrum with race, right? This is where, Du Bois's double consciousness, this idea of Jim Crow, these are those different elements or factors that we struggle against. And when you know that there are people working against you, you can both know how to or figure out a way to approach that or try to avoid it altogether. And so it's this idea of negotiating in one's mind and one's space, how do we continue to pursue excellence or opportunities, knowing that there are people or systems in place that will refuse you.
Tell me about how you have negotiated that? I mean, you are and have been successful on a level that a lot of people can't even imagine. You've been an NFL football player, and like I've said, you're a published author, mm-hmm. you've been a professor, you're a curator at Emory University. How have you experienced people not wanting you to succeed, right. perhaps, and coming to your own understanding of your pursuits right. and your ambitions?
Well, quite frankly, I've worked extremely hard. I have worked extremely hard, to make sure that all my I's were dotted, my T's were crossed, and over-prepared more than most people. When I started graduate school, I actually asked the administration not to announce that I played in the NFL until after I got through my exams. And then when I was writing the dissertation, it would be fine. But just so that I would not be kind of isolated or alienated as someone who didn't belong here or, have stereotypes work against me. It was already, a situation where I was one of very few African-American men pursuing a graduate degree, but to have this idea that I was a former football player, I thought was going to harm my opportunities to be in dialogue with professors or even my colleagues in a way that was equal. Expectations would have been very low. So I didn't want to have that challenge on top of, reading the 250 books over a 4-year period to complete the process.
Can you, looking back, do you feel any sadness over not being able to share your entire story as you were living it?
I don't. I think it's something that you learn over time by observing other people's experiences and really observing the time in which you're in and the circumstances that you have to make choices. And so, where I was, I had been out of school for a while, of course, playing professional football for 10 years, beginning in 1991 and finishing in 2000. I had gone back to school at UMKC, as a matter of fact, pursuing a master's degree early in my time in Kansas City. And then I'd also published 2 books while I was in Kansas City. So it wasn't that I wasn't capable. It was that, there are expectations placed on, particular people and occupations. And so expectations are not necessarily high. So what I did was I protected myself the best I could by keeping that to myself and, shared it with only a few of my colleagues. But after I was, passed my exams, then the rest of it was all about writing. And that was mostly in isolation anyway.
Well, Pelham McDaniels, I'm going to switch gears with you for just a minute before we have to say goodbye and ask you what you're looking forward to doing other than giving your reading from your new book when you come back to Kansas City.
I think most, I just want to connect with people I've known for more than 20 years now. I mean, I moved to Kansas City in 1992 and, my family moved back in 2007 and we moved back to Atlanta, but, I still keep in contact with a number of my colleagues in Kansas City. And so I just want to come home and say hello.
But there's no place that you're going to visit that's like calling you?
Yeah, well, there are a couple of places, Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, the Black Archives of Mid-America. I'm giving one of my talks is at the Lucille Bluford Library. And so I'll probably travel around the city in what free time I have just to stop off and say hello. But Nelson Atkins might get a visit from me as well.
Well, cool. Pelham McDaniels, it has been really great chatting with you today. And I'm excited about your new book.
Gina, thank you for having me on. It's always a pleasure to talk with you.
The Hemp Breakers is Pelham's new book. It's a novel, and he will be at the Kansas City Public Library for a reading on October 10th. You can check the library's website for details. But now, Bob Jones Shoes has been a staple in downtown Kansas City since 1960. The painted facade of that building is a landmark, and if you grew up here, you probably have Bob Jones Shoes memories of one kind or another. I know I do. We used to make an annual trip there this time of year to get the whole family stocked up on boots when cold weather was coming. Well, Bob Jones Shoes announced that they were closing their doors late last month. And the news sent lots of Kansas Cityans downtown for one last visit. KCUR's Suzanne Hogan has the story.
Nancy Trout is perusing the size 7 aisle.
And I saw that they were going out of business. After crying, I decided I needed to come up and buy.
Did you really cry?
Kind of. I just went, oh no.
Trout is wearing a pair of vibrant multicolored leather sandals that she bought from Bob Jones last year. She traveled from Wichita today to pay her respects and, of course, try to find a few more pairs of shoes.
I have enough shoes to last me for another 10 years, but I'll be stuck going to one of those chain places instead of here.
Bob Jones has just been one of those stores where you can find unique fashions that you don't see at other big retailers. And it's been especially vital for people who have different shaped feet.
I have narrow feet.
Margo Nelson is here looking for fall boots. She says shoe shopping can be such a personal thing. And for her and her family, Bob Jones has been the go-to spot.
I have a twin sister with narrow feet and my mom has narrow feet. So this is the only store in Kansas City besides Nordstrom where we can even find narrow widths.
Which is a sentiment that Kenny Kay can relate to.
It's the only place that I've ever been able to find Stacy Adams in my size. You know, I'm a big guy. I have, my father said, a great understanding. Big feet.
And what is your size?
15. I'm about to go on vacation, and that's exactly what my girlfriend told me to get. My size, man. First place I came.
And where are you going on your vacation?
Vegas.
And you know who else needs a vacation? Harry Bosley.
Been very busy.
Bosley is a partner in Bob Jones and has worked here 35 years. He's looking forward to spending more time on the golf course once the store sells out of everything and finally closes its doors. Even those iconic American Indian sculptures at the entrance are for sale.
Well, Bob Jones was into Indian art, but Bob hasn't been with us since 1976. But we just kept the tradition going since people were used to seeing them.
Bob Jones and Ernest Horowitz started the business in 1960 as a discount store that sold all types of things like underwear, motor oil, mink coats. In the 1980s, as downtown was in decline, Ernest's son, Rocky Horowitz, took over the business. Rocky changed the store's focus to shoes, and over the years, it's become a multi-generational meeting place for shoe lovers, like Mary Jo Audley.
I brought my daughters down here because this is an iconic place and it's going to be gone soon and they've never been.
The Audleys get a picture in front of the iconic large painting of shoes on the side of the building that reads, "We give everybody fits." But 22-year-old Allie Audley is definitely here for more than a photo op.
I found a few pairs. They're comfortable and they're cute and hopefully my mom buys them for me.
Those are pretty sexy.
Thanks.
Owner Rocky Horowitz floats around the aisles of the store, offering fashion advice and taking in these final days.
Stories everybody has is very sweet. They're very wonderful. You know, generations of kids and people have been coming through, so it's emotional.
He says it's hard to say goodbye to the store that he grew up in. But after so many years in the business at age 66, it's time to enjoy retirement.
What's the first thing you're going to do once the doors officially close?
Oh, gonna go find a beach.
Any beach in particular?
No, just no beach. Just a beach somewhere.
And what kind of shoes are you gonna wear?
I don't know. I'll find something.
Rocky Horowitz and Harry Bosley plan to keep the store open until the last piece of merchandise is sold. Then they'll be able to finally kick off their shoes and relax.
That was KCUR's Suzanne Hogan at the iconic local retailer Bob Jones Shoes. Bob Jones Shoes is closing after more than 50 years in business. And that's a wrap for today's Central Standard on KCUR. We talked about aging through the lens of a locally made film called The Tree. And we spoke with Pelham McDaniels about his new book, The Hemp Breakers. You can catch anything you missed at kcur.org/centralstandard. That's kcur.org/centralstandard. We'll have it all ready for you later today. That's where we archive all our past shows. And you can also sign up to have these conversations sent to you like a podcast. kcur.org/centralstandard. You can talk to us anytime on Twitter. We love talking to our listeners. We are at KCURCST, and I am at Gina KCUR. Tomorrow, we're going to hear the story of a historic Kansas City neighborhood, Leeds. Do you know about it? If not, you should definitely tune in for that conversation. We'll also be playing the most recent episode of My Fellow Kansans, a podcast all about Kansas politics leading up to the governor's race in November. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell with Coy Duggar, Kathleen Pointer, Suzanne Hogan, and intern Sophia Gillespie. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stick around for Up to Date next.